You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. This week, we take a trip back to Christmas, 1980, and find ourselves in the county of Suffolk. It seems more than just Father Christmas decided to visit the area that year. What occurred has become, for some, one of the most compelling UFO events in modern history. For others, a messy series of misidentification, exaggeration, and downright falsehoods. To discuss the Rendlesham incident, I'm joined by Dr. David Clark, who has seen the complete MOD record, spoken to every alleged witness, and visited the area several times. We discuss the case, the version in the 1980s compared to the version some claim today, why we think the Alan Godfrey case is far more interesting, the ATIP situation, modern ufology, and modern folklore. I hope you find our discussion thought-provoking. So, in other news, I recently joined Paul Sinclair for a live stream chat last week, which was great fun. You can view it on the Truth Proof YouTube channel if you wish to, and I discuss ufology, Bigfoot, and poltergeists, so check it out. As always, you can get early access to the show and exclusive episodes and prizes by joining our Patreon, so make sure you click on the show notes to find the link to sign up today. You can subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters YouTube channel by simply searching for Mysteries and Monsters. We're also on Facebook under Mysteries and Monsters. And you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter under Mystery Monsters. Thanks to Dean Bestel for the artwork. And the show is produced by Brennan Storr from the Ghost Story Guys. This show is part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Okay, let's delve into the murky mess that is the Rendlesham Forest incident with Dr. David Clark. Christmas 1980 became a week ingrained in UFO history due to the alleged events that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest, adjacent to Brentwater's military base in the southeast of England. Almost 40 years later, Rendlesham is still debated and argued upon to this day. As we approach the anniversary, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. David Clark to try and unpick this ufological mess. David, welcome back. How are we?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you, and thanks for inviting me on again.
No, thanks for wanting to come back.
Second dose.
Yeah, well, our first conversation about Stocks Bridge is still getting downloaded every week as we speak. So,
That's good to hear. Good to hear that people haven't forgotten the mysterious events out there.
Yeah, I got one of those emails, which is a bit of a strange compliment, which basically said, "I really enjoy your show. You even made David Clark sound entertaining and informed on the subject." And I thought, "Oh, you cheeky monkey!"
Yeah. You can't please everybody all the time, can you?
Oh well, I've learned that very quickly doing this, David. I thought it was a very good conversation, and it was like I say, it's been one of my most popular shows.
Yeah, and I think you used some of the recording that I did way back, didn't you? Which was it was weird to listen to that again.
Absolutely, I must admit it gave it a bit more gravitas, because I think it's often one of those subjects. Before we dive into yet another often misappropriated and misquoted situation with Rendlesham, that Stocksbridge seems to have two versions of it. There's what actually happened, and then there's the modern interpretation of it.
Yes, and I think you can say exactly the same thing about Rendlesham as well, because there's the few facts that can be established from the original documents and the statements that were made at the time, and then there's this vast edifice that's emerged since. And I've got to say, even though I've tried to keep tabs on it, it just keeps producing new things constantly and going off in weird sort of directions. And that really is how legends behave. You know, and it's the debate that these things produce that keeps them alive. And it's a good story, basically, both of them, Stocksbridge and Rendlesham. And that's why we're talking about them now, so many years later.
Yeah. I mean, Rendlesham is one of those cases because before I decided to re-embrace my love of the weird, I really kind of got fed up with ufology because it essentially seemed to be the same three stories going over it and over it and over it again. And Rendlesham was one of those, especially because it's often called the UK Roswell, though yeah. It doesn't really seem to be a very similar comparison when you look at the events alleged to have taken place, David. So
yeah,
I kind of got fed up of the same things being talked about, but also the thing about this, and I heard this mentioned on another podcast recently, Ryan Sprague's Marvelous Somewhere in the Skies, where he described one of the witnesses' different or version of events now compared to what was originally said back in the 80s as a developing version. Now, obviously, it was probably just at the cusp of your journalistic career when this broke, because I think it was the News of the World that got the scoop back in the early 80s, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. I remember avidly snipping it out of the front page of the News of the World with a pair of scissors when it was first published. You know, when you actually read the news on dead trees rather than sort of clicking on a link online. So I've still got that front page from the time in my sort of collection, and it was an amazing thing. I mean, a UFO story that was actually on the front page of a Sunday newspaper. You know, UFO lands in Suffolk, officially confirmed, etc., etc. So it was a huge thing at the time, no doubt about it.
Yeah, I mean, it is probably for a young person at that time. It was one of those stories that just seemed to appear at the right time when I was very open-minded and diving into these subjects. So
yeah,
it just seemed to just land at the right time, and it just exploded. Primarily because I think they'd managed to get a hold of Colonel Holt's memo, and that's what was originally leaked to the press, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. I think Jenny Randalls, who was obviously, she was a big cheese in Beaufort at the time and was, again, a bit like Nick Redfern, she was churning out books constantly on the subject, and Rendlesham just appeared right at the time when she was looking for sort of a meaty case that she could get her teeth into. And I think she tried to get the Holt's memo. She knew that there was an official report that he'd produced because she'd actually been on base and spoken to him, and he'd confirmed that that was the case. But, you know, because we had no freedom of information at the time in this country. I mean, it wasn't until 2005 that you could officially apply for copies of things like that. So I think it was a colleague of hers in America. Was it Ray Bosch that actually used freedom of information? And the ironic thing about this was he applied to the United States Air Force for a copy of this, and they had to then go to the Ministry of Defense in London because they destroyed their own copy of it. So the MOD was saying to Jenny, no, we haven't got it and we can't provide you with it. But when the Americans asked the British for a copy, the British supplied the Americans with it, and then the Americans got the copy and sent it back to us. That's how ludicrous this situation was. So that's how we got to see it, because the Ministry of Defence, even though they had a copy of it, wouldn't release it because they had no legal requirement to do so, because we didn't have freedom of information. I mean, it's easy to talk in hindsight because we've had it now for 15 years. We're talking back here into the Stone Age, 1983.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think it's little things like this, because the thing about Rendlesham is every time you think it's kind of been solved, something appears and you think, well, that doesn't really make sense. And this was one of those prime examples where the MOD said, no, we don't know what you're talking about, sorry. And yeah, then all of a sudden this appears. So then straight away you think, well, what have they got to hide? If there's nothing happened, what's all the secrecy? Why does it take another government to get this actually released? And therefore, what are the British public being protected from? And I think once you start a story like that, David, it just gives it a whole new traction in regards to the conspiracies and cover-ups straight away.
Absolutely, yeah. But I think the unfortunate thing here is just the nature of the British establishment and the fact that everything was kept secret. You know, and they're just so reluctant to release information to the public that usually is completely harmless. And the thing is, by refusing to release stuff, and they'll give you all, I mean, the current obsession is with Data Protection Act. You know, they can't give you anything that has personal information in it, because which has been taken to ludicrous extremes. But there's always been this culture of official secrecy, and it doesn't just surround subjects like UFOs. It concerns everything, you know, nuclear energy, color of the carpets in Whitehall. They've always been obsessed with keeping everything secret in this country. So I think because people are interested in UFOs, are obsessed with the subject, they don't necessarily see all the wider context of it. If you're a journalist and you're working on trying to get to the truth of about a number of different subjects, you realize that this kind of obsession with not releasing information is just endemic in British institutions, and always has been. And even with freedom of information now, it's still there. I mean, we went through this sort of glory days of freedom of information when it first came in 2005, where we managed to get lots and lots of stuff out of them. But now that's all being sealed off. You try and get a response to an FOI request, even the most innocent one now, and you're wasting your time, because they're just blocking everything. I don't know whether it's the coronavirus or whatever, that they just don't want to have to respond to people. But the, you know, those days when you could make a request and get something useful in response to it are long gone. So we're back to the bad old days, I think. But this is getting away from the key thing about the Rendlesham case and what they actually held on it at the time and why they were so reluctant. And you're quite right, Paul, when you say that the very fact that they're being reluctant and that they've been cagey about it is just, it's almost like given, provided the conspiracy theorists with a stick to beat them with.
Hmm.
You know, and it's not just this caginess, it's also the fact that they have deliberately destroyed files on the subject. That did exist at one point, and someone has decided, well, this is a load of rubbish, why do we need to keep this? Let's bin it.
Mm.
And as a result of that, when, you know, freedom of information came along and people have said, well, hold on a minute, there's a file missing here. What's happened to the DI-55 file from 1980 at the time that's disappeared from the sequence? You know, it just looks suspicious. And when they went back and did a proper survey of the files, which they were forced to do following the introduction of freedom of information, they themselves said, oh, this looks really bad. When this gets out, the fact that we've destroyed stuff, then people are going to think there's a conspiracy. And they realise this themselves. But you can't undestroy files, can you? So you can't prove a negative. So people are always going to think now, ah, well, yeah, they've released this bit of paper and that bit of paper, but what about this file that's been destroyed or they claim has gone missing? You know, what's in there? But I hate to sort of let people down, that there's lots of other examples in the 20 years that I've been in this game where I've been told that there's a file that's missing, and oh, it must be something amazing that they're trying to conceal. And on a couple of occasions, I've actually managed to get hold of it. And when you do actually look through it, you just think, "Is that it? Is that what they were trying to hide?" And it's like, "What? There's just nothing there. You know, there's nothing to get excited about." And you come to realise that a lot of the files they've destroyed is because someone's looked at them and thought, well, this is a load of rubbish, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, why do we need to keep this? And also, people are looking back in hindsight, and we now have such a thing as electronic storage.
Mm.
So you can scan pieces of paper, you can keep them on a computer hard drive, and they're not taking up space. But that's only a recent thing. And what you've got to understand is that up to about 1980, all these records were files, paper files that filled up filing cabinets. And there came a stage, like at the Ministry of Defence, where they got an entire room full of UFO files. And someone who was in charge of that, you know, one of Nick Pope's predecessors or successors, said, oh, we're going to have a clear out of all these old files. I can't even get into office because it's so full of them. So somebody's sort of gone through the filing cabinet and just lifted entire collections of files and just thought, well, do we need to keep all this stuff from 1950s? Nobody's going to be interested in that. Let's just chuck it in the bin. And that's what's happened. I mean, it's like somebody once said that, you know, there's nothing strange. There's nothing as powerful as the truth, but often nothing as strange. And that is the truth. That's what happened, I think.
Yeah. I mean, It plays, like I say, things like that, regardless of the reality of it, especially because it, you know, it was often a joke that we see in certain sitcoms and comedies of that era, that everything had to be done in triplicate and you had to save it, and then you had to do a response in triplicate, and by the end of it you'd ended up doing 12 pieces of paper and all saying the same thing.
Absolutely.
And so these had to be stored somewhere, and yet there's more to this as well, because I think there's numerous aspects of this, because at the end of the day we're also in the height of the Cold War, and there have been numerous allegations that the Americans were keeping nuclear weapons on British soil, which was against certain treaties, and maybe that was the reason they were so secretive in regards to what was really going on, regardless of the events of that Christmas, David, which, to be honest, is probably a more reasonable understanding of what they were trying to keep covered up, because that alone is a whole different kettle of fish, breaking certain treaties and essentially having an access version of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
But you see, I don't buy this theory that, you know, that they spread the UFO story to distract from something like that, because to me it just doesn't make sense. And this takes us to Nick Redfern's elaborate theory about LSD, etc., etc. Why would you do something like that if you wanted to hide something? You know, it's had exactly the opposite effect in that it's drawn attention to it, and you cannot now bring an end to that obsession with what went on there. So they've done exactly the opposite that what they were intending to do if they wanted to conceal something. And I think also the thing that I've learned after all these years of working in the archives is that you really need to rely upon the original documents. Now I know that I've said that a lot of them have been destroyed, but there's enough of them that have survived actually in context to actually give us an idea of what really happened. And I think the most significant thing from the files is, where did Colonel Holt's original memo end up in terms of files? And that may seem a strange question, but when you actually go to Q, you can actually order up the file that contains the original piece of paper that he signed. And it's not in a file on its own right. I know there was a Rendlesham file that was assembled later, which is the one that got all the press attention. The actual original report with the covering note from Donald Morland, who was, if you remember, the British base commander who was on holiday where all this happened, is in the general sightings file for 1980, along with thousands of other reports, just in the middle of that. So the desk officer at the time, Nick Pope's predecessor as desk officer in 1980, who I've interviewed, Simon Whedon, clearly remembers it. He just came in along with all the other lights in the sky that he had to deal with as a junior clerk at the Ministry of Defence. And he said it was no big deal. I just filed it with all the others. We didn't pay any attention. I spoke to one of the RAF guys down the corridor who said, something about, you know, probably poachers out with lanterns, or maybe Orford Ness Lighthouse or something like that. And we ran a few checks with the local radar stations. They hadn't detected anything unusual, and so we just forgot about it. And that, what he's saying, if you actually go to the original documentation on file, it corroborates what's on file. And, you know, I phoned him up out of the blue in, I think it must have been about 1999, 2000. So it was 20 years after he'd worked at the MOD, and he'd retired. He'd actually become a vicar. That's what he was working as when I found him. So he wasn't part of the British establishment. He wasn't some spooky intelligence officer. He was just a school leaver who got a job at the MOD and suddenly found himself the UFO desk officer. And after he got fed up at the MOD, he left and trained to be going to the clergy. So me ringing him up out of the blue was just, he couldn't have predicted that. So I don't think for a minute he was lying. And what he said to me was absolutely backed up by the documents at the National Archives that he remembered filing in that file. So to me, that is hard evidence, whereas all this speculation and, you know, what people have remembered 20, 30 years later without any documents to back them up is secondary. You see what I mean?
Yes.
I'm going with this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the thing about it, because in their opinion, it was nothing remarkable.
No.
And I think that there is a very interesting parallel with, obviously, a case that happened about 7 weeks prior to that, which is obviously the Adeline Godfrey abduction.
Yes.
Which are probably the two most well-known UK cases. Which I,
and that is fascinating, that
one. I mean, I've always found it very odd that they seem to happen really quite closely in comparison to other ones, because after that we've not really had a major incident that seems to have captured people's imaginations as much.
That's true.
So it's always been an interesting sideline for me that our two most well-known cases outside of the UK are both within seven weeks of each other. Not particularly close, because obviously Alan's is Todmorden, which is a good hour from where I am, because I made a pilgrimage there last year just to have a wander around the town. And
so did I.
see the sights, and it's a lovely little town.
See the story in The Sun last week about an animal mutilator, a cow mutilated at Todmorden.
Yes, so strangely enough, I got an email from a listener. So if she's listening, hello there, who's a member of the Todmorden UFO group. She sent me that picture.
Yeah, and again, it just shows you that story just won't go away. Now, the difference between that and the Rendlesham thing is that as much as it's fascinating, the Alan Godfrey story, it is single witness. And also, again, going back to the thing about the files, it just shows you how, again, original documents can actually shed some light on the way that the story has sort of become part of the UFO mythology. Because, interestingly enough, there is no report in the MOD files from West Yorkshire Police about Alan Godfrey's sighting itself. Now, that is a whole story that we could spend hours talking about. But what there is, you know, there was the story about the three police officers who were on the moors and who saw lights in the sky. Yes. Supposedly the same night that Alan Godfrey had his encounter. Mm. Well, their report is in the files, but it's not the same night. Mm. So we know the night that Alan Godfrey is supposed to have had his encounter. And if you read Jenny's books and you read all the sort of the accounts of the Alan Godfrey encounter, it sounds as if it's corroborated, because the same night these three police officers were up on the moors, you know, and they saw this strange light dive into the valley. And afterwards, that's when Alan had his encounter. But when you actually look at the report from West Yorkshire Police, their sighting was a week before Alan Godfrey's encounter. So you see how these things then, in retrospect, get put together and become part of the legend, the accepted legend that people then think is good evidence for UFOs, when actually it's full of inconsistencies. And if we go back again to what I was saying about the Rendlesham case, when you look at the original documents, Lord Hill Norton was given a secret briefing by the Minister of Defence on the subject in 1983. Again, this came out from the files. And when he asked them, why didn't you take it seriously? The Rendlesham case, here we had an American serviceman, a senior officer, who went out into the forest, saw UFOs, etc., etc. If he was deluded, then obviously if he was mistaken or deluded, then that's obviously of great defence significance. Mm. And if there was something there that he was seeing, it's also of defence significance. So how can you justify saying that we don't need to look into this any further? And their response, which is on record, I think is the key to this, because they say, we didn't take it seriously because Colonel Holt didn't take it seriously.
Mm.
Think about that. They said, what did he actually do? He went out in the forest, he saw these lights, and don't forget, this is like two nights after the initial thing, where they supposedly encountered this landed craft that sparked all this off. So what did he do? He typed out he didn't even type it himself. He got his personal assistant to do it for him. So a one-page memo when you actually read it, it doesn't actually sound very exciting or urgent. I know people think it's the most important piece of paper in the entire history of mankind. But actually, when you look at it, it's somewhat nothing. It doesn't even say UFOs. It's titled Unexplained Lights.
Hmm.
You know, and if you compare that with the stories that he's coming out with now, it's a world apart from what he's saying now, what he actually put on that memo. And two significant things in there. He got all the dates wrong. You know, both of the dates he put in that memo and the times about the initial sighting of the object that supposedly landed in the forest and his own encounter are both wrong. So he sent this thing through. And what did he? And what happened was he waited until Don Morland, the base commander, British base commander who was the official liaison between the American forces and the British Ministry of Defence. He waited for him to come back from his Christmas holidays, which was like the way things are done at that time. It was like 2 weeks later. Mm. And when I spoke to Don Morland about this, I've got a really good interview with him. He just said, oh, well, he sort of sheepishly invited me into his office and sort of said, oh, Don, while you were away for your Christmas holidays, the aliens landed. It was like, and he thought, are you pulling my leg? You are serious. You're not being serious, are you? So Don Morland said that what he did was, in order to sort of test Chuck Holt, as he calls him, you know, he said, well, put it down in a memo and I'll send it through to the Ministry of Defence. And he didn't think he was serious about this. So he thought, if I tell him to put it down in writing, he won't do it. You know, and that will be the end of it. But he was then surprised that he did actually fire off this one-page thing, which, as we know, was full of errors. But do you see what I mean? So this is why the Ministry of Defence didn't take it seriously, because they thought, well, when he was out in the forest and he was seeing all these incredible lights zooming around and beams coming down to the ground, he was in charge, or he was deputy, because he wasn't actually in charge, because the actual base commander, Ted Conrad, was actually talking to him on a walkie-talkie at the time. So he was actually in charge. But if he seriously thought that there was a threat to that NATO base, where, as you've said, Paul, they suspected that they had nuclear weapons, all the rest of it, if he thought that these lights were a threat to that base, you know, it could have been a Russian Spetsnaz or whatever, he wouldn't have just stood around, made a tape recording, and then when it got to 4 o'clock in the morning, went back to bed, would you?
No.
You'd have pressed the panic button. He was in direct connection to the RAF Air Defence at RAF Watton. He did actually patch a call through to them and said, look, I'm seeing these strange lights. Can you confirm anything on radar? And the radar people looked at the picture and couldn't see a thing. Nothing there. Neither could Ted Conrad see anything from where he was standing at Bentwaters, because he was talking to Colonel Holt on a walkie-talkie. He was scanning the sky along with some of the special police officers as well that were stationed in the forest. None of them could see anything. So in the end, he just gave up and went home. So all of that scenario effectively led the Ministry of Defence to say, well, if he didn't, nothing became of it. We couldn't describe it as a threat, you know, and to actually press that button and send up the quick reaction alert, you know, the RAF lightnings or whatever, you know, if you do something like that, it costs money. It produces an audit trail. Yeah. And no one wants to say, oh, we scrambled the jets because of some light that somebody had seen over a forest. It costs thousands of pounds that the public pays for, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
See what I mean?
Absolutely. And that's one of the aspects where whenever I get over carried away with this story, that's the one thing that always reminds me, because I studied wartime history, so I was fully aware of how tense everybody was in Europe in the late 70s and 80s, and often incursions would occur and people would be sent into the air to escort them back out of British airspace or out of the European Union airspace. None of that seems to have happened at all, which kind of says, well, clearly nobody felt worried or frightened that this was a major event. And surely, when you're on a military base, your first thought would be, well, if it's going to be anybody, it's probably the Russians.
Yeah.
And none of that seems to have happened. And like you say, at the time, until the story broke, it didn't seem to have developed. It just seemed to have disappeared off, ironically, off the radar. But
very good, very good.
Yeah, I'm very good at making.
Was that spontaneous?
It was, yes. Yeah. I'm very good at dropping puns in without realising it. But it seems to be some kind of inert talent I have, David. But so, when the story got out and everything, I think what's perplexed me the most is that the story that came out, even when we looked at when it sort of came back into fashion in the mid-90s when everybody went UFO nuts in the world, it seemed, by this point, the story had begun to change and didn't seem to be, well, not that it wasn't exciting, but essentially we have three nights of people seeing strange lights in the skies and interactions, allegedly. And then by the mid-90s, there's more going on already. I mean, compared to even now, it's almost like it's a completely different story these days.
Yeah, because there's only so long, isn't there, that you can tell stories about people seeing mysterious lights, and it becomes boring and the novelty wears off. Mm. So that, in order to keep the story alive, in order to keep it in the public eye, and let's be fair about it, we've got to be straight about this, that some of the people involved, they've got ulterior reasons for keeping it in the public eye. You know, Colonel Holt's retired from the United States Air Force, and it's become a nice little thing in his retirement, hasn't it? He's constantly being sort of given opportunities to travel to Europe, to stand in front of lectures and to write books and go on TV. What's not to like about that? You don't want to kill the goose that lays the golden egg, do you? He's not at some point going to turn around and say, oh, well, maybe it was the lighthouse after all. It's gone too far for that.
Mm, yeah.
And also, there is this thing that the Americans seem to be prone to, even more than we are, this sort of thing about the credible witness, that somebody that's been in the military, someone who's served in the Air Force or the Army, they're elevated to sort of godlike status, you know, that they're military heroes, and if they say that they've seen something, I'm doing my best Nick Pope impression here, you can take it to the bank, you know. They would, that kind of attitude. The fact is, these people, yeah, they might wear a uniform and they've got stars and stripes and all this, that and the other. They are human beings in the same way that we are, prone to exaggeration, prone to mistakes, prone to telling stories to make things that's happened to them sound more exciting than they actually were. I mean, we've seen it in loads of other examples. I mean, why all of a sudden do we trust what military people say when it comes to UFOs as being 100% accurate, whereas if that same person was trying to justify why we invaded Iraq to find non-existent weapons of mass destruction, we wouldn't trust what they were telling us. But because they're telling us that they've seen UFOs and the aliens are here and we've got captured technology, suddenly they become 100% trustworthy. I just don't get it.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense.
It is an interesting twist on it, because that always makes me laugh. I mean, I remember once seeing a documentary on the Discovery Channel a few years ago where they essentially had someone defending the US Air Force and the US military in general in regards to UFO sightings. And he essentially was saying that the US military had never lied, ever. And they put it to this other person they were interviewing, and he just started laughing. He said, well, should we start with the Vietnam War and take it from there?
Sure.
And it is incredible that it does seem to elevate certain stories when certain people are involved. There is a very interesting aspect to what you've just said there in regards to people and their version of the Rendlesham incident. When Nick Redfern released his book, The Rendlesham UFO Conspiracy, a couple of months ago, he was saying that he had been contacted when he announced the book was coming out by two or three people involved in Rendlesham or part of the Rendlesham situation, basically asking him how dare he release a book without their input, which
really?
I found very telling, because he was essentially, as you just referred to there, certain people have made a very nice living out of Rendlesham.
Yeah.
And then it's not the only UFO case, David, that has, or other cases of the paranormal or the Fortean, where certain people have made a very good living out of certain aspects of ufology across decades.
They have, and they become very territorial about it. And there's various people who whose names I won't mention, Nick Pope, who regard it as their territory, that no one else should be allowed to write about the Rendlesham incident. That it's their case, and they're all like fighting like cats in a bag. I mean, there's absolutely no agreement between any of these different people. They've all got their own little groups who are sort of abusing each other and sort of spreading hate about each other and saying, oh, his testimony is unreliable and this bloke's a liar. And, you know, how can you believe any of it? Because there is no consistent story at all, that apart from what I've just said about the original documents from the time. I just don't think you can place any credence upon what any of these people have said. The only exception to this, I would say, John Burroughs,
yes,
who I've had lots of contact with, and despite the fact he's got some very peculiar ideas about having been irradiated by UAPs and plasma and this, that, and the other, and I can understand how he's reached those conclusions. When he actually tells the story about what he actually saw, it's actually quite refreshing because it is pretty much exactly what he wrote at the time.
Yeah.
He hasn't added to it, in any great way. It is simply that, you know, he saw these peculiar lights. He didn't see an actual object. He was standing close to Jim Peniston and, you know, all the amazing things that Jim reckons happened to him. He was there but didn't see any of it. You know, how do you explain that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was about to mention John because his version seems to have been the most consistent.
Yes.
It's also, in the scheme of things, probably the most unremarkable. But the one thing, like I say, the one thing about Rendlesham is occasionally something will happen, David, and it'll draw you back in. And John is that reason for me, because obviously John unfortunately has suffered from severe ill health in the last couple of decades, and therefore tried to apply for medical insurance because I believe he needed an operation to repair some damaged heart valves.
Yeah.
And he was turned down because they said he was never there, which ended up with him getting his senator, John McCain, dearly departed John McCain, to get involved on his behalf. And lo and behold, firstly, they said, after initially saying he didn't serve at Bentwaters, that he did, but then his medical records were classified.
Yeah, and then they lost them, no doubt.
And essentially, I mean, that alone adds more fuel to this fire, because if there's nothing to hide, why would you tell someone who clearly was there that he wasn't? And then even if you'd then change your mind in that, why would his medical records be classified? Because he was basically seriously ill and he needed this operation but couldn't get the insurance cover because it claimed he'd lied about his service record. And then Senator McCain got involved, and lo and behold, his records were released, he got his insurance, he had his operation, and he's making a full recovery. That alone just throws more fuel on the fire, because people go, well, clearly that just confirms it. And but yet,
doesn't that just go back to what we were talking about earlier, though, about the British documents that they said we couldn't have or that had been destroyed? It isn't necessarily that they're trying to hide something. The problem is with these huge institutions like the British Ministry of Defence and the United States Air Force that just don't want to have to respond to requests, reasonable requests for documents such as medical records. You know, what you need to... to anyone who's listening to this, who has worked, for example, for an English local authority, as I have, you know, when you get a request from somebody, can you dig out this record from 30 years ago? You just think, oh, do I have to do that today? Yeah. You know, this is going to mean like rooting through piles of stuff, you know, in some dusty filing cabinet. Oh, and I've got something more interesting to do. Let's just put him off.
Worked in file cleansing, and clearly some people have no idea how that's supposed to work, David.
But you see, that's not sexy, is it, what I've just said?
No.
It's far more interesting to think, oh, yeah, well, they've got aliens hidden away and they just don't want to admit it.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, the other thing as well is that, obviously, when this story started, we had Jim Peniston, John Burroughs, Colonel Holt, and a few other people that were out with Holt.
Yeah.
Now, I'm aware of at least a dozen people who claim to have seen things, most of whom seem to have appeared in the last 5 to 10 years, David.
Yes. And I think if it can't be shown that they were there at the time, and it's, I mean, I know there are difficulties in establishing that, then I think you've just got to treat their stories with suspicion. And again, in all other areas of folklore and legend, when you get something like this that's spoken about and published, people want to get in on the act. They want to feel that they are part of it because it's a living legend, and they write themselves into it, and in some cases they actually genuinely believe that they were there. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe this explains the you know, the situation with can't remember his name now, Art Wallace.
Yes,
there was the pseudonym. Sorry, he's going to hate me for not remembering his name. But you know who I'm referring to. There's been a lot of controversy about certain people who claim that they were there, who Colonel Holt says wasn't, and I don't know. I've just got so bogged down with the detail of it, I've lost the plot.
Yeah, I think the most notorious witness is Larry Warren.
Larry Warren, that's him, yeah. Yeah, but in terms of, like, people coming out of the woodwork, you know, you were saying about Nick Redfern having various people contact him. Mm. You've got other people who are playing pranks as well, just to sort of wind people up and to see, it's trying to seed things into the story. Mm. And one of these is this chap who, I said, but he could be a woman, or who knows, who sent me the story about the Special Air Service being involved, you know, yes. about the whole thing being a prank that was played on the Americans by the SAS, because the SAS had done this secret exercise to test the perimeter of the base to see how secure it was, you know, pretending they were Russian Spetsnaz or something. They'd been captured by the Americans, who were actually on the ball, beaten up, and one of the senior officers, the Americans who captured them, had said, oh, you know, these are enemy aliens. And eventually, when they got back to base, to their Hereford HQ, they said they were obviously cheesed off about this and thought, right, well, we'll go back and show them some real aliens. Mm. You know, so it's a cracking good tale, and whoever concocted the nonsense obviously has got a good imagination. And they sent it me on the 30th of March, I think it was postmarked.
Yes.
So it arrived in my pigeonhole at work on the 1st of April. So I knew it was a prank. They knew it was a prank. But I've never been able to work out who it was who sent it.
Yeah.
And I sat on it for like 3 years thinking, you know, they're going to try somebody else with this story and somebody else is going to bite. So I left it as long as I possibly could. And I thought, this is such a good tale, I've got to tell it. Mm. So a couple of years back, I put it on my website and then all hell broke loose.
Well, yeah. That made me laugh, because I remember then, you were then being touted as the man who solved Rendlesham by saying, oh, this is what it was. Whereas what you were saying was, I've been sent this and I don't believe a word of it. However, when it appeared in the press, you were saying, this is what happened.
Absolutely. And that to me was more significant than the story itself. It just shows people want to believe all these fantastic theories, you know, and the Nick Redfern's latest is just another example of that. And, you know, the SAS thing, if you're somebody who thinks that aliens is nonsense and UFOs are nonsense, like your average Daily Telegraph reader, they would think, ah, it was those chaps in the SAS, they were behind it after all, that kind of thing. So it fits that narrative, doesn't it? That sort of mindset would think, you know, it was our chaps that was just taking the mickey out of the Americans. That explains it. And that satisfies them. They shuffle off. But then there are other people who just simply can't accept that people see ordinary things in an extraordinary way, you know, like meteors and lighthouses. So even though that hard evidence is staring them in the face and is quite clearly the best explanation for this, they don't want to resolve it that way because that's too simple. They need something else. So that's why they have to go looking for plasmas, and they have to go looking for SAS, and they have to go looking for LSD experiments, you know, because they need to keep the story running. And that's the nature of the UFO myth. And that's what's going on in America at the moment with the what's the latest thing? The Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon Task Force. ATIP. You know, ATIP. It rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
Yes.
You know, I just find that story just absolutely fascinating. I am not in the least bit interested in this so-called hard evidence, these videos of what look like balloons and drones and things. What I'm interested in is, how come that story has planted itself in the New York Times? Who has been showing Leslie Keen and Larry Blumenthal and these other people or this so-called evidence? Somebody's deliberately pushing this story for a reason. Follow the money. Mm-hmm. Somebody's making a lot of money out of it. And why are they trying to revive interest in UFOs now while we're in the middle of this pandemic? You know, is it some kind of distraction technique? Is it sort of like, is there some sort of secret sort of intelligence war going on between the Russians and the Americans? You know, there was that story about the Russians having tested this rocket in outer space, wasn't there?
Mm.
You know, so if you're the Americans, you might want to think, well, let's let the make the Russians believe that we've got a crash flying saucer and that we've got all this technology that we've being back engineering. All we've got to do is just get some of these gullible ufologists to sort of take them into our sort of confidence, show them a few dodgy videos, and then get it into New York Times. You know, how much would that cost? You know, a few rounds of coffee.
I mean, the thing about that is, obviously, I've devoured everything that's been on TV about that, with the Unidentified series, which was the first one in regards to ATIP, and obviously the current second season is showing in the States.
That's right.
Hasn't been aired over in Europe yet.
Yes, I've got to declare an interest in that I'm on that.
Oh, are you in the second season?
Yeah.
Right. I look forward to seeing you on that then, because
I'm the token skeptic.
Ah, well, I would expect no less of you. What struck me, the most interesting aspect of that first season for me, was not all the USS Nimitz interactions and obviously the other incident that happened on the East Coast. The thing that made me sit up and take notice was when they went to Italy and met this conglomerate of Italian scientists and former military personnel talking about the UFO that shot down an Italian military helicopter. And they claimed to have photographic evidence of this.
I must have missed that episode.
Because I remember seeing a few years ago there was a mysterious outbreak of fires in a town and nobody could explain what was happening. Light sockets were blowing up, microwaves were blowing up, TV, anything electrical was catching fire, even when the power was off, things were blowing up. That's where this incident had happened.
That is a fortium coincidence, isn't it? Sort of weirdness.
Because why these aliens apparently took a shine to this particular village in southern Italy, I don't know. But they were saying that incident happened at the same time.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah.
I mean, it is very interesting. I mean, they've had a lot of criticism, obviously, because of some of the people that are involved in the organisation as well.
Yes.
But once again, we have the situation where the US government officially stopped investigating aerial phenomenon in 1969 when they shut Blue Book down. We now know, once again, that they've been lying. Now, where this aerial phenomena is coming from, who's to say? However, once again, you've got this situation where a government makes a statement and sits on a standpoint and says, right, we've no interest in this, only for it now to all becoming unravelling. But once again, they've gone, yeah, but we're not doing it now. And you're like, well, you said you weren't doing it 10 years ago, and you were.
Yeah.
I mean, how do they expect people to actually believe them?
Well, I don't think they do, but I just think governments are such huge institutions. I mean, particularly in America, where you've got like a myriad number of different competing intelligence agencies. I mean, you just can't get your head around them. CIA, DIA, NSA, and all of whom are all sort of fighting for an ever-decreasing sort of pile of money that they are provided with. And all of them are all operating things that perhaps other agencies don't know about. So I think, again, it's difficult to get your head around the fact that when, say, someone, you know, like the chap you mentioned who you heard saying, we've never lied about this subject, he only knows what he knows. I think this is the problem, that when somebody is asked, have you ever investigated UFOs? I mean, I doubt even the president doesn't know, because these things are all sort of compartmentalized. And even within the same intelligence agency, you've got somebody who may even work on a desk next to someone else who doesn't know what that person is responsible for. So I think it's quite easy to say why they're lying to us, but it's like, you know, the information is only as good as the person who's providing it.
Yeah. I mean, I've never understood the argument that people have that somebody would tell the president, because presidents are transient. They come and go.
Yeah.
They do not run the country. They are a figurehead. That's all they are. You know, they're not the people, you know, they're not the people oiling the wheels in the background in the departments of defence and such like. They're simply passing through, you know. The longest a president can be there is 8 years. Why would you tell them the most secretive information on the planet?
But I'm also unconvinced that this so-called secret investigation that's been going on in the US military amounts to very much at all, because the people that are making the whole noise are a small group of people who are obsessed with the subject personally. You know, Robert Bigelow, a millionaire who's just throwing money, buying people's archives and claiming that he's got all this evidence, which is actually just material that's already in the public domain. And people like Hal Puthoff and some of the others who are involved, they're all self-referencing each other, and they keep this the claim that they've got access to this top secret information. But despite the fact that the story was first broken in whenever it was, end of 2017, what has actually emerged of any significance since that time? I mean, even the three videos that they officially released to great fanfare in April during the pandemic, there was nothing new there. I mean, it got all that massive press attention, and we'd seen it all before because those videos were already in the public domain and had been for years. You know, and apart from those videos, all of which have got down to earth explanations, if you look closely enough at the people who've done analysis online, apart from them, what else have we got? Exactly. From the $22 million that apparently has been shoveled in the direction of Robert Bigelow.
Robert Bigelow's a very clever businessman, because obviously, you know, he made a very tidy profit on Skinwalker Ranch, because I discovered the other day he paid $200,000 for it and sold it for $4.6 million.
Yeah. There's a lot of money involved.
And I was very interested in Skinwalker Ranch, and then I read the book and watched the three episodes of the series, and that's me done.
I do think, though, they trip themselves up a bit, the people who are pushing this story, because, again, it's this novelty value. There's only so long you can keep telling the same story. And if you look at the most recent story that's in the New York Times a couple of days ago, written by Leslie Keene, who's a dyed-in-the-wool UFO believer, and Ralph Blumenthal, they've started to introduce this thing about the crashed sources that have been hidden, and that they've apparently the various military people have been given briefings on. Well, there's only so long you can keep pushing that one before someone's going to say, right, where is this stuff then?
Yep.
You know, and if at some point they've got to come up with something, and when they don't come up with something, which they won't be able to because there aren't such things, what are they going to do then? They're going to have to find some other direction or distraction that they can keep the story alive.
Yeah, it does seem a little bit like history is repeating itself, though.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I'm not as sceptical, and I'm probably because I'm too much of an optimist, David. I have to be brutally honest. So for me, I've been very interested by this drip, because my frustration is, and there seems to be a little more frustration coming from the UFO community, or the people that are open-minded, shall we say, that I think a lot of people are seeing warning signs that if you've got an interest in ufology, we've been here numerous times.
So many times in the past we've been down this road.
I've lost count how many times somebody said the US military's got UFOs. Countless times. And
I mean, think about it. What have we got an anniversary coming up for quite recently? Next month, it's the 25th anniversary of the alien autopsy.
Yes.
At the end of August.
Yes.
Do you remember 1995 or whenever it was, the excitement, the anticipation, and the same story that we're getting now, that, oh yes, we're on the cusp of something. You know, they've been feeding us all these drip things for years, and clearly now we're you know, the American government are going to tell us that we're not alone, and that, you know, that this thing is real. What was it? It was a hoax.
Yeah.
And we're going down the same path again. This is the thing with ufology. It never learns from the past.
Well,
it just keeps repeating the same errors over and over and over.
Yeah. Strangely enough, I've just done a show for my Patreon about the alien autopsy anniversary, because obviously it's the cover story of July's 14 times, celebrating the 25th anniversary.
Absolutely.
by a friend of the show, Stu Neville. So
great article as well, really good.
Yeah, so I've had a good chat with Stu, and that's on our Patreon about it. I spoke to Spyrios last year, who is the gentleman who is the creator of the video.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting revisiting it, because when it all came back to the surface last year, I remember doing my intro for the interview with Spyros, And I basically said, if there's one thing in ufology I never thought would come back and see the light of day as being held up as evidence, it's this nonsense. Yeah. Because even back then, in my X-Files obsessed early 20s, David, I sat down that lovely summer's eve. It's a Friday night. Why I wasn't in the pub on a Friday, I know what I'd rather have done looking back. It didn't take me long to get into the pub after this. I sat down and watched that on Channel 4 on the 28th of August.
So did I.
And yep. I went, within a couple of minutes, I was just like, this is absolute bobbins.
Yeah. But a lot of people still believe it's you know, a real film of aliens being autopsied. Yeah.
But I think that's when belief overtakes proof, yeah. Because that's the other thing. Some people are so entrenched, and this applies to all kinds of phenomena and all kinds of walks of life, David. We can't, let's not just tar ufologists with this brush. I think a lot of people in a variety of professions and beliefs are of this ilk, that belief just powers them, that there is a real need to believe it, regardless of how nonsensical it can be. And because I've been interested in the weird and wonderful, I tar myself with this brush as well, being a cryptozoological lover. So
it's a classic phrase from the X-Files, isn't it? I want to believe.
Yes, exactly. You know, it's the poster on my office wall at home. Is, you know, I have that poster next to my Bigfoot Crossing poster.
And so, it's not specific to UFOs either, because if you go back to the end of the 19th century with the rise of spiritualism,
yes,
if you look at what happened there, and some of the big names like Oliver Lodge, you know, eminent physicist. Mm-hmm. Who, you know, a bit like Sherlock Holmes and Arthur Conan Doyle, you know, he knew his stuff, and he in terms of scientific method, mm-hmm. and yet he was completely and utterly taken in by a bunch of charlatans, you know, who were sort of saying that they could communicate with dead people, via knockings on tables and things.
Yeah,
you know, so it's not something that's specific to ufology.
Yeah, absolutely. Strangely enough, I was talking about Helen Duncan the other day, because that case keeps popping back up with people trying to get her pardoned because they claim that she was sent to prison for breaking the Secrets Act, which is not true at all. She was sent to prison for being a fraud.
Yes, that's true. But again, it's like what people believe. This is back to what we were saying right at the beginning, and the few certain facts from the actual documents at the time, which are often the most reliable form of evidence.
Absolutely. In terms of the
alien autopsy thing, you know, you were saying about how you keep getting drawn back into this subject after you think you've sort of had enough of it. That the alien autopsy thing was the time when I was sort of drawn back into this, because in the 1980s, when I was like a schoolboy ufologist dabbling in the subject, I'd sort of largely abandoned it in the early 1990s. I then got a job, as you know, working at the Sheffield Star as a journalist. And it was because that the British UFO Research Association decided to have their annual conference at Sheffield Polytechnic, which is now Sheffield Hallam University. That's where the first public premiere of the alien autopsy film was shown.
Yeah,
and I covered it for the Star. So I went along and I met all these people that I used to know, you know, Andy Roberts and Phil Mantle and all the sort of people. Mm. And it was from that point I then got immersed in the whole thing again. you can't get rid of it, can you? It just keeps coming back.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like a bad meal.
It's frustrating for me as well, because obviously I don't know why, because I was in, you know, I was living in Sheffield at that point. I had no idea this had happened till about 5 years ago, alongside the fact that John Keel turned up in Sheffield, which I still to this day can't believe that I wasn't there to see the great man. You know, just to be in his presence would have been enough, David. But that was a really interesting thing, because obviously there's an interview with Philip Mantle in this month's 14 Times on the back of Stu's article, and he refers to it there, that they showed it to packed auditoriums for 2 days.
That's right. Yeah.
And it was on telly on the Friday.
He was fending off the media, you know. He was I remember a particularly fraught sort of semi-interview with Ray Santilli and who was the German guy, was it Michael Hesseman, and Philip And it almost got to blows. And it was like, you know, and people were demanding to see the evidence and this, that, and the other. And it was sort of ufology, delicious, hot, disgusting, cold. You know, it was fantastic. Those were the days. What we're getting now is just a pale imitation of what went on back then.
Yeah, well, you know what's coming next? Surely we've got, the time is ripe for a new alien autopsy video, David.
Yeah, well, we've got the 40th anniversary of the Rendlesham case coming up, haven't we, this Christmas? And I think isn't there supposed to be some kind of new TV drama that's going to be on Netflix called Rendlesham?
Oh.
And we've also got the Larry Warren film.
Capel Green.
Capel Green that should have been released some time ago, but God knows what's going to happen to that.
Yeah, that's been coming out for 3 years.
Yeah, well, they haven't made it up yet, have they, properly?
I couldn't possibly comment.
Yeah, so I'm sure we're never going to hear the last of this, and I think that's why I think in that little film that I participated in, that Codename Rendlesham thing, I was trying to make the point that this is a legend that's almost comparable to, you know, King Arthur and Robin Hood in its longevity. I think we'll still be talking about Rendlesham hundreds of years, long after we're all dead and buried. It's going to live up, carry on growing and accruing new stories and new sort of aspects to it that we can't even begin to imagine.
Strangely enough, there was an article, I think, that came out about a year ago on the BBC and essentially said that exact thing about Rendlesham. There it is now for modern folklorists and modern folklore. It's become so entrenched in the psyche of people that it has now joined the pantheon of King Arthur,
absolutely,
and Robin Hood and the likes of those people. So it is very interesting that no matter what happens with this particular story or which particular version we get or whose particular version we get, because as we touched on earlier, there does seem to be one person who has been remarkably consistent throughout it all. They've never claimed to have seen anything untoward or had psychic messages or special cords delivered with coordinates, aliens, people. I mean, the truth serum story seemed to turn up about 15 years ago, which was a whole new situation to me. It'd be remiss of me not to mention, obviously, Peter Robbins, who was a big proponent of a specific version of it, who then came to the conclusion that none of it was true and basically held his hands up and said, I'm terribly sorry, I've been conned.
Yeah, and there's numerous examples of this, isn't there? And again, I mean, the whole binary code thing, I just find that story just completely preposterous. And yet, because the person behind it is a retired, you know, sergeant or whatever, because he's military, he's got to be telling the truth.
Well, ironically, I've noticed in the last couple of weeks, a lot of people have brought Bob Lazar back.
Bob Lazar, yeah.
Because now, because of the New York Times article and what's going on, the catchphrase on the internet is Bob was right.
Yeah, I was talking to Sarah Scholes about this on our UFO Lore podcast the other night. You know, her book They Are Already Here is, I just think, a fantastic piece of work, and she was saying, and the thing about Bob Lazar and Area 51 is that it's impossible to disprove that he didn't work there. You know, everyone suspects that he's just making it up. But you can't. How can you go into Area 51 and say, you know, well, let's see your personnel records to see whether this guy called Bob Lazar works there? I mean, I could say I worked at Area 51. How could anyone disprove that? I suppose there'd be people out there who think I work for MI5 anyway. You know,
yes.
So. Yeah. it all depends what you regard as evidence, doesn't it?
Yeah. The one thing about it all that surprises me, though, is living where we live, I've always found it very odd that, you know, we had a very similar kind of strange incident that happened, I think, 1997 at Heaton Moor, David.
Oh, yeah. Howden Moor, sorry.
And that was very peculiar, primarily because so many people were convinced that they'd seen something to the point, you know, like you were on about, what didn't happen at Rendlesham. The exact opposite happened at Howden Moor. We had hundreds of people searching the moor for an alleged crashed aeroplane or whatever it was, and within a year, that had become UFOs have landed. Aliens are running about on the in the Peak District, living in caves.
Yeah.
So it just shows you that once certain stories get picked up, it seems they seem to run away with it. Whereas Howden Moore, I think that was a good, 50, 60 people made reports to the police claiming to have seen a flaming ball coming through the sky?
Yeah, there were some people that heard explosions and things as well. There was a gamekeeper that heard a very loud bang. And, you know, I mean, I did a lot of work on that at the time. Again, I was working on, I was reporting for the Sheffield Star, so I was able to sort of pretty much work on that full time for a while to get to the bottom of what happened. And the bottom line on that, it was the RAF. Doing what they do, you know. Yeah. You know, pressing the accelerator pedal a bit too fast when they were zooming around over the Peak District. You know, but that's the basic facts of it, but that's too straightforward to satisfy people who are looking for evidence of aliens and cover-ups and all the rest of it.
Yeah, absolutely. But then again, once again, we have food for the conspiracy, though, dude, because when it was originally put to the RAF, they said no. No, nonsense. And then the British Geological Society went, hang on a minute, we've got a recorded sonic boom here.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it was like, well, maybe we might have done something.
Yeah. but that's how governments behave, though, isn't it? I mean, if they don't have to admit something, they'll try every which way to get around admitting it. It's like the thing with the what would appear to be a very straight question: were there atomic weapons stored at RAF Bentwaters, Woodbridge? And if you tried to get a straight answer on that from the government, you won't get anywhere, because they just deploy the standard: we cannot confirm or deny.
Yeah.
You know, this is how governments behave, and we shouldn't be surprised that that's how government behave. I mean, you only have to look at how things, what's happened with the COVID-19 situation, you know. I mean, the amount of material that must be being destroyed or hidden, or people trying to cover their tracks, to cover the mistakes that they've made over this. Mm. You know, it's going to take decades to get to the bottom of what really happened.
Yeah. I was laughing. There's a gentleman, I believe he lives in Florida, who's been arrested for misappropriation of COVID relief funds, who made the subtle decision to buy himself a top-of-the-range Lamborghini. And didn't think that anybody would spot this bright orange monstrosity flying around where he lived. And so nothing surprises me. I mean, when I grew up as a child, we lived on an RAF flight path, and there was local petitions because they kept flying over and breaking the sound barrier. You could hear them coming from miles away, and they flatly denied doing it. You know, there's hundreds of kids playing football. We can see it. We can hear it. Until somebody filmed them on a old school 1980s video camera, and all of a sudden the flying past stopped, and people's windows weren't being broken anymore when they went through a sonic boom over Woolley. So it just shows you that unless you can prove that they're doing it, they'll deny it till they're blue in the face.
Of course they will, because by saying that something, it was us, we made a mistake, it opens them up to then further questions about, well, what else are you up to? And, you know, if you've made a mistake, then I want compensation because my windows were blown in by your sonic boom, you know, that kind of thing.
Yep.
So it's just standard stonewalling, I think is the word that they use. and that going right back to what we began this discussion, you know, the thing about how did Colonel Holt's memo get released in the first place? If you go back all that way back to 1983, when Jenny Randles was trying to fettle that out of the Ministry of Defence, that's exactly what they were doing with her. They were saying, oh, sorry, we don't know anything about it. You know, he may have made a report, but we don't know anything about it. So because they had no reason to release it to her, and they knew if we let Jenny have a copy of this, we know what's going to happen. It's going to be front page of the News of the World, which is exactly what happened. So delay it for as long as possible. Maybe I can get another job somewhere else in the MOD by the point that, the shit hits the proverbial fan, so someone else can deal with it. Mm. You know, that is a lot of what is going on. People just can't be arsed, you know, to sort of go and find whatever bit of paper they've been asked to find. You know, they want to do something else, you know, play some game online or something like that, rather than doing the job they should could be doing. Who knows? But it's often a simple solutions, really, rather than complex ones involving cover-ups. Cock-up is more likely.
Yeah, very probably. I mean, yeah. is it surprising, David, that we're still talking about Rendlesham as we approach its 40th birthday, where outside of the UK it's probably one of the two cases that are most well known, but really it's not the most remarkable case in the UK UFO history. It's certainly the one with not as many witnesses as some of the most remarkable UFO cases up and down the country. It's perplexing, but once again, do you think it falls into the fact that the witnesses are classed as credible because of their career?
Yeah, and they're Americans as well, don't forget. So it is almost like an American case that just happens to have occurred in the British Isles. And I think the fact that you've got the deputy base commander, Colonel Holt, and all these various other people, it's got that credibility. And the fact that there are official documents as well involved, these are the things that give these sorts of stories credibility in a lot of people's eyes. And also, back to the sort of the folkloric aspect of this as well, it is a good story. I know it's not as exciting or as dramatic as some of the other UFO stories, but the fact that it has lived on and it's become embellished and it's gone off in all these different directions, it's mainly because the original story has actually got a sense of mystery and enchantment about it. I mean, the fact that these people, it happened in a forest, and again, forests are places that are redolent with like mysterious happenings. If you go back into folklore and folk literature, you know, it's where mysterious things have happened to people right back into the mists of time, isn't it? It's in lots of ghost stories and things about, you know, the Blair Witch Project was set in a forest.
Yeah,
you know, so you've got all those folkloric aspects to it that make it a damn good story. And this is the thing about folklore, there's lots and lots of stories that are interesting or exciting but just don't survive, that get forgotten about, that don't get repeated. And it's the ones that stand out, that are unusual, that have got all these interesting elements that people, that make them easier for people to tell and repeat, and that's then what makes them successful, and that's what guarantees that people will keep talking about them.
Yeah,
I mean, that's what interests me.
Absolutely. I mean, the one aspect as well in regards to Nick Redfern's latest book was that he uncovered that area of Suffolk and across the border into Norfolk, there's a long history of very strange stories and weird encounters in that area. And as you touched on, lots of them traditional British folklore, like the Shooks being sighted and encountering terrified locals back in the 17th and 18th centuries. And then you've got a wonderful story of an alleged Nazi invasion that were destroyed by a special heat ray as they tried to invade the beach. So there's a history in that particular area of strange things anyway. So Rendlesham is probably another footnote in that area's long tradition of unusual encounters, regardless of what phenomenon people encountered.
Yeah, I mean, even on the UFO aspect, there was the famous case in 1956, you know, the Lakenheath Bentwaters case that I did a lot of research on 20-odd years ago, you know, where you got the things that were seen on radar and aircraft scramble from all over East Anglia to investigate. And also, I, when I was at the National Archives, I actually went through some of the base logs. Because originally it was a British base up until the 1950s, the 1940s, when the Americans arrived. And there was there are some logbooks, you know, sort of daily occurrence reports. And I was just skimming through there, and I found a record from, I think it was from 1946, where a blazing light had been seen from the control tower. That's the same one that was involved in the 1980 incident over the Rendlesham Forest. And they'd scrambled an aircraft or some kind of rescue aircraft because they thought it was something that had, another aircraft that had caught fire and crashed into the sea. So they launched this sort of air sea rescue operation and didn't find anything. But again, that was in 1946, and very, very similar if you look at the details of you know, compared to what happened in 1980, where you got these airmen out at night, saw a blazing object that appeared to drop into the forest, went in to investigate, and, you know, the rest is history or folklore. Mm-hmm. So it's not something that's isolated. It's something that went on. You can trace back in the history of the area for ages. I mean, and the event itself, like you said yourself, happened over three nights. Now, if you think about that, people assume it was one incident, and that the and that there was a UFO or UFOs that were causing that incident. So the obvious question is, where did they go when the sun came up? Do you know what I mean? You've got that first night where they'd seen this thing land, and then another night, and then another night when Colonel Holt went out. So where was this UFO in between, if you see what I mean? And how do we know that the thing that was supposedly seen on the first night was the same thing that was seen by Colonel Holt two nights later? No one seems to ask these basic questions. And if you look at what they actually said they'd seen, they obviously saw a completely different thing on the first night to what they saw on the second night.
Yeah.
Or they saw the same thing, but in a different sort of circumstance. And what was the one thing? What was the one thing that was consistently there for both nights?
I'll let you say
the Orford Ness Lighthouse, which recently fell into the sea.
Yes, demolished.
It's head up. It's obviously had enough of all this, so it's decided to drop itself into the sea.
Yes. Well, strangely enough, I was watching Josh Gates' Destination Unknown recently, and they'd rerun a four-part special he did about UFOs. And, of course, unsurprisingly, he was in the UK to check out Rendlesham. And they ended up, because I think the lighthouse had been decommissioned in the late 80s, early 90s.
No, it was definitely still flashing about 10 years ago, because I had a midnight trip there to investigate it myself and saw the flashing light, and you know, it was really unusual. When would that have been? Probably about 2005, 2006.
Ah, right. Because he had to get it rigged up. Because it certainly had been decommissioned when this show was filmed, which I think was 2017.
Sometime after the period I'm talking about.
The strange aspect about that was that they went to the alleged site and tried to recreate it. And I thought, well, it's 37 years. With the greatest respect, trees grow.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't give you a real interpretation. I mean, obviously you can sort of have a look at it and see if it could, but you're talking about such a length of time.
Yeah.
It surely couldn't be a reasonable comparison. It turned out that they couldn't really see much anyway, unsurprisingly. But yeah, once again, that's Rendlesham reappeared, because the lighthouse story being decommissioned, that's not a very remarkable story. Yet it became a major news story because it's the Rendlesham Lighthouse.
Yeah. But you see, there is this misconception that the people who want to believe in this regard the lighthouse story as ludicrous, because they say, how can a lighthouse fly around? How can it crash into the... appear to sort of crash into the forest? But that's because they don't understand what is being suggested. No one is suggesting that the lighthouse explains all of it.
Hmm.
What if you look carefully at like Ian Ridpath's theory, which is elegant and covers all the key facts, he's not saying the lighthouse caused the initial sighting. Mm-hmm. He's saying that the initial sighting was caused by the bolide that we knew shot through the sky at 2 a.m., which is the date and time that Colonel Holt got wrong on his memo.
Yep.
But that's what triggered the whole thing off, them seeing that.
Yep.
And then they went into the forest, and that's the point where they saw the lighthouse. Mm. But that distinction is lost on most people. Mm. And then you get the sort of nonsense about, oh, well, these highly trained military personnel could not have possibly mistaken a lighthouse for a UFO. I mean, pull the other one. They weren't all highly trained military personnel. A lot of these guys were 18, 19-year-old, first time they'd ever been out of the USA, stuck in this freezing cold British base at Christmas when they wanted to be home, doing whatever it is they do at home. They were, you know, John Burroughs has said to me himself that he'd never seen the lighthouse until he actually went into the forest with this UFO incident.
Mm.
You know, so the idea that they were all familiar with it and knew exactly what it looked like is just crazy. It's just not true. And if you read some of the descriptions from people who actually lived in the area, for instance, Vince Thirkettle, who was the forester who actually lived in the forest at the time.
Yes.
He was the one who originally came up with the lighthouse theory way back, way before anybody else mentioned it. And he himself, even though he lived there and he was often like jogging through the forest to keep fit, etc., when I interviewed him, he said there was one occasion where he was jogging down one of these long sort of logging roads in the forest, and he saw this light coming towards him. And he thought, oh my God, it must be, you know, it must be somebody out doing some illegal poaching. He sort of crashed to the floor and sort of hid his face. And then after a couple of minutes, he looked up and he thought, oh, it's a lighthouse. You know, so this is a guy who was living there every day, seeing the lighthouse every day, and yet when he saw that beam of light, he thought it was something else.
Yeah.
So the idea that you couldn't possibly make a mistake isn't borne out by the facts. And if you look at the statements that those three people, I think it was five statements at the time, the ones who went into the forest, all of them say that they saw this flashing beacon. They didn't know what it was. They followed it. Sorry, I'm going ahead of myself here. They didn't know it was a lighthouse. They saw a flashing light, and it took 4 hours walking through the forest, getting completely soaking wet, crashing into streams and that, and then they worked out that this flashing light they'd seen was a lighthouse.
Hmm.
You know, so the idea that they were all familiar with it and they could possibly be mistaken is just doesn't stand up to scrutiny.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it could, because at the end of the day, how many people are we expected to have been wandering about at night? Anyway, this was a military base. The majority of staff, I would suspect, probably worked daytime hours, or they worked on the base. They weren't wandering about the woods.
Exactly. And the key thing about the lighthouse to me is, if you listen to the famous Halt tape, the bit where he's saying, "There it goes again." And on that film that Adrian Frierson did, The Codename Rendlesham, he does this really well. He actually plays the tape and he shows an actual film of the lighthouse recorded, I don't know, 2000, 1995 somewhere. Mm. And he times it with him saying, "There it is again, sir. There it is again," and you can see it flashing.
Because the other aspect of this is, like, once again, I think we'll finish with this a little bit, is the fact that Penistone took notes and wrote things down whilst he was there.
Yeah.
None of which bears resemblance to the version he says now.
No.
Holt's tape is an audio representation of what actually happened that evening. That doesn't match his description of the event now either.
No. And don't forget that is edited as well, because it's not a continuous tape. He's switching it on and off at various points.
Mm. Well, that's the other thing, because a lot of people think that's a continuous recording, and it isn't. And it's also not the original.
No.
He doesn't have the original anymore.
No.
It's a copy. So, well.
I mean, honestly, if you had to go into a court of law with all this information, you know, and you were a barrister and you were trying to prove to a jury that this thing had happened, I mean, maybe that's a bad analogy, because if you were just choosing people to serve on a jury, the general level of belief in aliens in the country would probably encourage people to say, yeah, definitely proved. Well, if you were trying to prove it to, say, a panel of judges or to a panel of scientists, and they were saying, right, well, let's see some evidence then. Well, we've got this audio tape, we've got this memo, but the dates on it are wrong.
Yep.
And we've got these eyewitnesses who are all highly credible and highly trained military witnesses, none of whom agree even on the basic details, you know, of when this occurred and who was there.
Yeah.
You know, the judge would just throw their arms up in the air and just say, yeah, what, you're wasting our time. Mm. Off you go. Come back when you've got some good evidence. Wouldn't they, though?
Well, yeah, I mean, as someone that studied law for 2 years, if you turn up with a statement that bears no resemblance to your initial statement, you would be viewed very dimly by the court.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's all I've got to say on that matter, I think.
And you see, the UFO conspiracists would say, ah, well, yes, they would say that, wouldn't they? Because, you know, they're trying to hide all this. I mean, once you go down that rabbit hole, you're never going to come up for air again.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you see,
I go back to what I said right at the very beginning of this. If you want the truth is there, actually, in the original documents. However sort of flawed they are, if you actually go back to the context of the time and you know how to sort of reconstruct documentary evidence and sort of use it in the right, correct, critical way, you can actually work out exactly what happened.
Mm.
But unfortunately, that will not... again, it's this thing about the truth. There's nothing stronger. There's nothing more powerful than the truth, and often nothing as strange.
Yes, very true. Very true. I mean, one last thing before we part Rendlesham to bed. one of the other aspects, like I said, we've mentioned it a couple of times, the Alan Godfrey case. One of the things about that case that most people don't seem to talk about is that Heard account. that just appeared in a rugby field from nowhere. Yeah. Now, that's always been one of those really strange parts of that story. Everybody's more convinced about Alan's encounter, not a herd of cows appearing in a locked rugby field at three in the morning.
It's funny you should mention that, because that links back to that story, doesn't it, that we mentioned in The Sun about the cow that's been mutilated. So maybe, maybe someone's trying to tell us something.
Oh, I didn't connect that, yeah.
Because I'd forgotten about the cows, because that's what triggered all this off, wasn't it? That he was called out because these cows are wandering around in somebody's backyard when they should have been in a farmyard.
Yeah, and then they couldn't find him anywhere, and then they turned up and they were found in the rugby field, which allegedly was... Were they in a locked paddock and they escaped, or was the rugby... One of the areas, either where they'd come from or where they ended up, was locked?
Something like that, yeah. But I think it's a fascinating story, and it's been sort of a bit overlooked because of the prominence. I mean, this is the thing that I don't like about Rendlesham, in that it's become, like you said earlier, the UFO case from Britain, a bit like Roswell. Mm. And all the other interesting stories, like the like the Alan Godfrey thing, and like the one in Scotland, you know, the Bob Taylor story.
Brilliant.
They've all been pushed off the agenda. All anyone wants to talk about is Rendlesham, and this really annoys me with the media. When the media do a story on UFOs, it's always got to be Rendlesham. They've got to get Rendlesham mentioned.
Yep.
You know, there's far more interesting stories than Rendlesham, but it's overpowered everything.
Absolutely, yeah. I was lucky enough to... I've held Bob Taylor's trousers.
Have you now?
Yeah, I met Malcolm last year at a conference. Yeah. He fetched Bob Taylor's trousers with him, and I was very excited. It was probably one of the most exciting moments of my life, next to when I held the European Cup, Damon.
Yeah, well, it's a bit like one of these bizarre saints relics from the Middle Ages, you know, where you sort of touch it and you're almost like touching the supernatural.
Yes,
you know, it's a direct link to the aliens, isn't it? Those ripped trousers.
Yes, having visited a saint's tomb in Kefalonia as well, I can attest to that. Standing there watching people kiss.
Yeah.
A mucky piece of gold, and seeing the grooves in the construction where so many people had touched it, kissed it, held it.
Yeah.
It really takes your breath away when you see that kind of thing going on. I mean, it was fabulously interesting, but very strange.
Folklore in the making.
Absolutely. Right, before I let you go, I know you've touched on it. You're doing a little series of your own, I believe. So can you just tell us a little bit about that before I let you return to your normal life?
Yeah, I mean, this is not something that... I mean, I'm involved in it, but it was just something that came together. I think it was the earlier this year or the end of last year. I was interviewed by a chap called Jim Chisholm, who works for British Online Archives, which is like a thing that produces material for universities. And he recorded a podcast of me talking about my work in the National Archives on the UFO files. And we just got talking about it, and he was just as far gone as I am with the subject, and had always been fascinated with it. And where I work at Sheffield Hallam University in the journalism department, there's a colleague of mine called Richard Wilson, who is a TV reporter, used to work for Time Tees, who is also a massive UFO nut, and we just all the three of us got talking, and we thought, oh, wouldn't it be great if we set up our own like YouTube channel, and we could sort of like do an educational UFO program that tried to put some of these stories under the microscope and actually get real UFO witnesses interviewed. And we actually recorded, or part recorded, the first... It was originally going to be a YouTube a video thing, with us having our own channel talking about different cases, but then the pandemic came along and stopped us from doing that. So we thought, well, why don't we just do podcasts instead? So the UFO lore thing, which you can download as a SoundCloud thing, and you can find it in various places. I think it's on iTunes. So we've done about six or seven episodes, but it's similar to what you're doing, Paul. It's we invite someone on and let them talk about UFOs. So we've had various witnesses on, including a guy who saw a flying triangle over Sheffield. We've had Sarah Scholes, who's the journalist, a science journalist, the American journalist who's written the book called They Are Already Here. We've had Chris French, the psychologist, you know, who did the alien abduction study. So it's not something that we're going to produce massively regular. It's just now and then if we find someone interesting who's willing to come on and be interviewed, like I'm speaking to you, we'll do another another episode, and it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And also, I've been able to sort of grapple with various technologies like Audacity and get myself a webcam and things, which for a sort of 70s throwback like me it's been like quite an experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Audacity does tend to you learn things very quickly. I've laughed about it recently when I was talking to a friend who's also recently started his own podcast, and the first episode I ever did, I used Audacity as my editing software. It took me over 9 hours.
But you see, I can leave this to Richard and to Jim and to Alex, the other guy that's involved, because they're into all that technical side. So I'm just someone who comes on and asks a few awkward questions and puts a dampener on things, you know. I've made quite a career out of being the token skeptic. It's serving me well.
Well, listen, there's nothing wrong with being sceptical. I think the problem we've got, strangely enough, I recently interviewed Hayley Stevens.
Hayley, yeah.
And it was quite interesting because she's kind of moving away from the term scepticism, because quite rightly, I think, and I think that this applies to both ends of the spectrum of sceptics and believers, they are essentially the same because they are so obsessed with proving their version of the truth that it ignores everything in the middle. And like you've said a couple of times today, sometimes the truth is a very strange thing, and it's not all black and white, and it's not all exaggeration or make-believe. There are some strange things out there, and occasionally some people experience strange things.
Yeah, I totally go along with that. You know, people definitely experience strange things, and I hope that some of your more discerning listeners will realise that I am not a sceptic in the way that, say, Richard Dawkins is, who just dismisses any kind of, sort of pseudoscience of this kind as complete and utter nonsense, you know, superstition and all the rest of it. Yep. I don't think that at all. As a folklorist, I'm absolutely fascinated with these things, and there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that people have extraordinary experiences, but I don't think you're doing yourself any favour that by just accepting any story that you are told uncritically. Mm. I don't see how that helps us at all. I think you have to cut. Debunk is simply getting rid of the bunk out of the subject, so that the really fascinating stuff, like the Alan Godfrey story, you know, which Alan definitely had some bizarre experience that I can't explain. Mm. You know, that's the sort of story that we should be focusing on, and not nonsense about binary codes being downloaded into people's heads.
Yeah.
You know,
with coordinates to islands off the coast of Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, so as a folklorist as well, I mean, I'm doing this with two different hats on as a journalist, where you have to be. You have to sort of get to the bottom of some things, and you have to investigate, and you have to get rid of the nonsense. There's that aspect to it. But as a folklorist, I'm not concerned with what's true and what's false. I'm just interested in the subject and how it changes people's lives, and how it sort of enchants the world, the belief in these things. That's fascinating in itself. We're never going to get to the truth, because what's the truth? One person's truth is somebody else's falsity.
Yeah, yeah.
Entirely subjective.
Well, we all know that the only conclusive proof that most people will accept is when one of these damn things lands somewhere. I think.
Yes. Well, I think they'll be waiting a long time. This is me adopting the sceptic attitude.
Yes. Well, let's hope we're there when it happens, my friend.
Definitely.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen.
It'd be lovely talking to you, Paul, anyway.
Absolute pleasure as always. So, the show you're doing is called UFO Law, which is available on most podcast applications, and I'll put some links in the show notes. Are you still doing your blog as well?
I am occasionally, yeah. I'm going to write something about the alien autopsy thing to mark the 25th anniversary, because, you know, the fact that that conference was at Sheffield Hallam University, which is where I now work, I think I need to sort of write that up. You know, I think it's sometime towards the end of August. So I do occasionally update my blog, I think it's a good place to sort of, you need to have somewhere where you can put all the various bits and pieces that you do, you know, whether it's podcasts, bits of writings, articles, links to things in one place, and having a blog is probably the best place to do that.
Absolutely. Well, I'll stick a link to it in the show notes. What's it called?
It's just drdavidclark.co.uk, and I actually call the blog Journalism and Folklore, because they're my twin interests. that complement each other.
Fabulous. Well, listen, thank you as always, David. A pleasure. Lovely to speak to you again. Can't believe it's been nearly a year.
Is it really?
Yes.
So much has happened since the last time.
28th of October, I was just checking before I rang you.
Was it?
So, obviously I would have probably bumped into you soon, but pandemic has kind of put things on a shutdown for us all. So listen, you take care, lovely, and thank you again for your time. It's always a pleasure, sir.
Thank you, Paul.